Welcome. This is Ken McCarthy and Jazz on the Tube podcast. Today we're focusing on a chronicler of the art. And, you know, books are funny things. You know they're written by somebody, but sometimes a book just engulfs you so massively that it doesn't even occur to you that someone wrote it. And you get so much out of it, it changes your point of view so greatly. And today we're going to actually have the opportunity to talk with an author of a book whose book had that effect on me. And his name is Professor Douglas Henry Daniels, and he is a professor emeritus from University of California at Santa Barbara, Department of Black Studies and History. And he wrote a wonderful book, which I love to take out every now and then and peruse, called Lester Leaps In. And it's the history of the man and his times. And as Professor Daniels and I were talking about right before the call started, is the music comes from human beings. It's not a theoretical thing. It's not a mechanical thing. It's not something that fell from the sky. It comes from real human beings who live particular lives in particular circumstances. And my feeling is, the more you know about this, the more you're going to get from the music and understand it. So welcome, Professor Daniels. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and thank you for the kind words.
Well, let's leap in. What first inspired you to devote so much time and energy to chronicling the life of Lester Young?
Well, first there were the things I didn't want to do. I didn't want to do New Orleans, but I ended up with a musician who spent his first 10 years in New Orleans, you know. And I didn't want to do bebop and the music of the 50s because I kind of grew up with that. I wanted something different, which was because it's different from, you know, every other person is doing New Orleans or bebop. Very few doing the swing era. And since the swing era was a mystery to me, I grew up after the swing era, even though the big bands were still around. I grew up after the start of the so-called swing era. So I fiddled around and fiddled around, and I started to I had a fellowship at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History. And I went to the Library of Congress from there after talking with some people, and I began to read Downbeat starting in the 1930s, just fiddling around, you know, just getting some historical background of the times and the music industry. And it just so happened that the Smithsonian had collected something like 410 interviews with jazz musicians. And within a certain amount of time, those would become available. And that just happened to be during the period when I was researching this swing era and perhaps some swing era musician. And, you know, I went to the Institute of Jazz Studies without any clear idea of what I was going to do, but I started reading some of the interviews with the old-time musicians, the musicians of the 30s and 40s, etc. And then at some point, I wrote Buck Clayton and Joe Jones and some other musicians in the New York area because I was staying there with a friend. And Buck Clayton, who was teaching, I believe, at Queens College and had some familiarity with professors and classes and all that, agreed to an interview. So I went to his house, and one of the first things he told me was, you know, Lester Young's son lives here in the neighborhood. I said, yeah, that's very interesting. And I thought, well, I know he's younger than me. Well, what does he know? What does Lester Young Jr. know? Which, of course, was a major mistake. And even though he gave me the phone number and I didn't think much would come of it, he gave me the keys to the kingdom when he gave me the phone number of Lester Young Jr. because I talked to him for a couple of hours. And he kind of interviewed me to see who I was. And I'm like you. I believe that in order to understand this music, you have to understand the people and the history behind the people and the music. Yep. And so he put me in touch with members of the family, like Lester Young's brother, Lee Young, and told me that getting in touch with Lee Young would not be easy, but persist. And a few months later, I got in touch with Irma Young, Lee and Lester's sister. She's older than Lee and younger than Lester. And she embraced me like a long-lost relative when I visited her. And at some point along there, I decided to do Lester Young, obviously, but I can't recall exactly when. At one point, I was talking to a professor of mine, the late Larry Levine, UC Berkeley's History Department, and at one point I asked him, you know, of the swing era musicians, who do you think I should focus on? He said, Lester Young. Now, I didn't at that time know that he was a Lester Young fan, nor did I know at that time that Professor Levine tried to play the tenor saxophone. But I found that out later. And let's just say everything pointed to Lester Young. That's about the best way I can explain it. I may have written about this somewhere, and I would assume that that's the more accurate record than my contemporary story. But I didn't choose Lester Young, I tell people. Lester Young chose me.
Okay.
And the more I got to know him and talk to people about him, the more I liked him. As his sister said right off the bat, Lester was a rebel. Mm. But he was such a charming rebel, I would say.
Wow.
Very intelligent man.
Mm-hmm. That's been my experience, too. And I'm hoping for our listeners that the more you know about Lester Young, the more moved you are and impressed by his accomplishment. So maybe we should start with his early years. Where did he come up?
His father was a musician born in Thibodaux, Louisiana, outside of New Orleans, about an hour's drive west and slightly south, sugarcane country. And his grandfather had been a blacksmith, and he says this in one of his interviews, in fact, 1959, I think, interview, or maybe even 56, that his father was a blacksmith. And he had, the father, Jacob Young, had three sons, and Willis was the third son. The other sons were also blacksmiths, I believe, and Willis, Lester's father, was sent to Tuskegee, it said. And he was a professor of music, taught all instruments, taught singing, and led bands. Now, Lester says he grew up separate from his father for the first 10 years. Maybe the father was on the road, we don't know. But the mother can be found in the city directory of New Orleans, which are fairly reliable sources, during the World War I years. And that's what Lester recalls. That is to say, his first 10 years were spent in New Orleans. He didn't know his father was a musician, and he loved New Orleans music. That's when he became enamored, you might say, of music. Plus, well, I've talked about his father. His mother was a music teacher as well, according to the city directory. And she probably sang to her son lullabies and songs and things like that. And who knows, she might have had a piano and had students coming by, but we don't know. We know she was a musician, or that she played piano, at least. We know that. So there are different musical sources, New Orleans, and then more immediately, the family. And then his father came and took the children on the road. The mother and father split up, and Lester's father, Willis, took the children on the road during spring and summer and fall, traveled all over the United States playing, singing, dancing. They started out first, I think, the children at the age of 10 or 11 and 9 and 7 or even younger as dancers, and then played instruments. For example, Irma played the saxophone. She liked the saxophone, and she liked to dance. Hmm. And Lester also, it said, liked to dance and probably danced while playing the saxophone. The saxophone was a new instrument for people in the 1920s. And for someone who came out of vaudeville, because that's what the father was, basically, a vaudeville musician, that is, and a dance musician. That is, he had a troupe. We have a photo of it. It's in the book, the New Orleans Strutters. Lester is in short pants at about 15 years of age, and the father is there, and there's the minstrel show in the background. That is to say, from the late 19th century, the first indigenous, let me say, the first people like to say American popular musical presentation that emerged was minstrelsy, whereby white men blackened their faces and sang and danced and told jokes in imitation of African Americans, using African American dialect and degrading the African Americans in their song and their music and their dance and their intelligence and their dialect every way they could. But it was a hit in the 1850s, and this continued into the 20th century. And eventually a black musician said, well, if they can cash in on this, we should be able to cash in too. And so there was a black vaudeville tradition, TOBA, Theater Owners Booking Association, T-O-B-A, but it was known as TOBA. From the late 19th, early 20th century, there's this vaudeville tradition whereby blacks played instruments, others sang, others danced, and they presented skits of various kinds. Of course, always humorous skits, always comedic skits. And Lester's father led the band for the show. You know, the show is the dramatic presentation. And in this 1924 photograph, you see some of the people, some of the comedians are in blackface, including Lee Young, who started out as Lester's brother, who started out as a blackface performer, and then he went on playing different instruments. So this is what Lester was doing his first 15 years. Then his father had another side to him where he was leader of a dance band. You know, the saxophone was popular. Children playing musical instruments was, of course, popular. And dancing was the rage, the Charleston and other such dances, the black bottom were the rage in the 1920s, as well as polite social dancing. And in the evenings at the hotels, Lester's father would lead a dance band, or on campgrounds or in other places where people could get together, from Minneapolis to Louisiana, where people could get together and have a polite social dance. That's where his father excelled. And there's a picture of that dance band in Minneapolis in 1927 in the book Lester Leaps In. And so his father represented several different phases of the music industry. And plus, when they were living in Louisiana, the father and the family moved to Los Angeles around 1929, 1930. And Lester went on his own at that time. But when he rejoined them in 1940 or 41, his father was still in music, and he was teaching people in the neighborhood. So, and the father, of course, led a band, which was composed of several members of his extended family, particularly his grandchildren. Jimmy Tolbert, who was a lawyer, started out in, born in New Orleans, a grandchild of Lester, and several other Tolberts, members of the same family. Lucille Tolbert, they grew up under the father's, the grandfather's tutelage in after New Orleans, in Louisiana specifically. Let me back up. They grew up in New Orleans, and then during their teens, they moved to Los Angeles to live with their grandfather after their mother was injured in an accident. So the father was leading bands and deeply involved in music until he died. In fact, other than speak in church and lead church choirs, that's all the father did. He was thoroughly involved in music, as was his son, Lee, who played drums professionally, was the music director for Nat King Cole's Combo, and who then went into the music industry itself, including Motown. For example, at the funeral of Lee Young, several people showed up, one of them being Stevie Wonder, who gave an impromptu rendition of, I believe it was something religious, so it might have been the Lord's Prayer. And that's how involved the family was in music for generations. And the grandchildren of Willis Young were involved in music one way or another. James Tolbert was a lawyer, but he was an entertainment lawyer as well as leader of the NAACP. Jimmy Tolbert was the lawyer for Harry Sweets Edison, for example. He was a lawyer for Art Pepper, for example. So this involvement in music continued. And Lucille's daughter, Elizabeth, for example. Lucille Tolbert's daughter, Elizabeth, is a singer as well. I saw her sing. I heard her sing on one occasion at a memorial celebration for her uncle, Jimmy Tolbert. So Lester grew up like the Jackson family.
Okay.
Lester grew up in a thoroughly...
Okay. And for people that don't know the history, maybe you're a little young or maybe you haven't thought it through, we're talking about an era, especially for the father, when there was no such thing as radio, there was no such thing as TV, obviously. Certainly no YouTube, no iPods, it was all live. Everything related to music was live events.
Yeah.
So there was a different world in terms of playing opportunities, and social life was organized very differently than it is now. Just wanted to throw that in there for folks just so they can picture this.
Correct.
And can I also say something, or a question? I have a question about something. Lester Young's father's musical training was such that he could have easily been in a different time, in a different place, would have been a professor of music. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah. Like Ellis Marsalis, for example. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And different musicians these days, in my lifetime, have become professors, such as, for example, Archie Shepp, and at the University of Massachusetts, who was there along with Max Roach and, let's see, Anthony Braxton, after struggling for years as a musician, became a professor of music first at Mills College, and now he's at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, where he's a part of an ethnomusicology program.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he would have been a professor in some institutions. Yes.
And what year was Lester born?
1909.
So when you talk about Lester's grandfather, we're possibly talking about somebody who was enslaved or the...
Well, it's very possible, yes. We don't have any evidence that his grandfather, Jacob, was enslaved, no. And we don't have evidence that he was free either. All we know is that he was a blacksmith and a cooper, I believe, listed in the census of 1870.
1870.
And he was also a property owner, I believe. He bought some property in Lafourche Parish around 1869 or 71 or thereabouts, about the time his son was born. But we don't know if they were slave or free. We might assume they were slave for this reason.
Hmm.
Lester knew his grandfather was a blacksmith. Now, if his grandfather had been what they called free colored, or free in Louisiana, or free Negro, as they called them in other states, I believe that tradition, that knowledge would have persisted in the family.
Uh-huh. One thing, if I may pull something from seemingly from thin air, but I think it's important and significant, is some people might think, oh, he was a blacksmith, he must have learned that trade from the dominant culture, you know. But people really should know that the tradition of working with metal and blacksmithing, that is African craft, and it's not
impossible.
Oh, yes,
impossible. It goes way back.
Yeah, it's not impossible that his ancestors came over with that. And
Yes.
It's important.
That's a very likely possibility. That blacksmithing is something... If you pick it up, you probably pick it up from another blacksmith. And, for example, the famous grills, iron grills that you find on the balconies in various places in New Orleans have been attributed to, if not the handicraft, to the designs, at least, of African-American blacksmiths. What people don't understand was that during slavery, the artisans, the craftsmen, the carpenters, the coopers, the blacksmiths, the bricklayers were slaves or free blacks because, except for white immigrants, foreign immigrants, white men believed such things were beneath them.
Mm-hmm.
That was labor. All you needed was a gun, a fishing line, a few traps, on a cornfield, and you could get by. Why should you, you know, labor? So until the late 19th century, when white immigrants and others took over the skilled crafts and skilled labor, most of that was done by slaves and free blacks during slavery.
And I think it's important, because this, I have to say, something I'm only understanding recently, is those skills came from likely came from Africa. In other words, the grill work may be
European
look, but the actual metal on metal, that they were doing all that in Africa and brought that over, and this is something that we totally miss.
Well, there are some books on this subject, and those designs may have some features that we find in West African mythology and so forth. John Michael Vlach has written a book, has done a catalog, in fact, Vlach, V-L-A-V as in victory, V-L-A-C-H, I believe that's his name, done a book, The Afro-American Arts Tradition, in which, among other things, he focuses upon the work, the grill work that we've been talking about. And then people such as Robert Ferris Thompson, another art historian, has in like Flash of the Spirit, for example, one of his books has pointed out the similarities in certain West African traditions, along with Vlach, for example, in the representation of certain totemic figures, snakes and turtles and so forth, in the colors that they use in quilts, in the designs that they use in quilts and in carvings, for example. Scholars like these have pointed out that there's a rich African heritage behind much of what took place in the South. And we know that's the case in the music, for example. African musical traditions persisted. And during slavery, a number of people of African descent were violinists. The movie portrayed Solomon Northup, 12 Years a Slave. Well, he was a violinist, an accomplished violinist, and his attempt to make money is what led him to Washington, D.C., where he was drugged, beaten, and enslaved for 12 years. So a lot of people were singers and musicians and dancers, and some like W.C. Handy actually had the opportunity to go to school and study music. But you know, Handy's father did not like the idea that his son was studying music. W.C. Handy, famous composer of St. Louis Blues, for example, mm-hmm. and a very popular band leader. Anyway, his father did not want him to go into music. When Jelly Roll Morton, as a teenager, was discovered by one of his relatives as someone who played in less than respectable places at night, they threw him out of the house. So while there's this strong musical tradition, if it's not religious music, the people encounter all kinds of obstacles. Lester didn't have that problem.
Because his father was a professional musician that was familiar with the commercial side of music and at peace with it. And
the religious side. I think you hear, you know, in Lester's playing, I think Jimmy Heath said, you hear the soulfulness of black music coming from the spirituals and the church. A very interesting idea. Now, one critic wrote and said that this is a ridiculous idea. I can't hear any of that church music in Lester's playing. And my response to that would be, did you grow up in a black church?
There you go.
How could you recognize the soulfulness of black music if you're not familiar with the idiom?
Absolutely.
Of course you don't recognize it.
Yeah.
Of course you don't hear it.
Yeah.
But if Jimmy Heath says it's there, could Jimmy Heath be wrong? Do you know more than Jimmy Heath?
Well, I wonder, too, how many people know this. And I happen to find disparate clips, which I put together in a little video for Jazz on the Tube. I think it's under Jazz and Church Music or Jazz and Church. And I found a clip from a 1960s documentary on Louis Armstrong where he expounds on that. He says his music comes from the church.
Yeah.
The feeling of it comes from the church. And then I was friends with Ornette Coleman, and he and I used to talk a lot. And one day I actually recorded one of our conversations. I had just gotten back from New Orleans, and it made him think of his experience in New Orleans. And I have this on tape. People can hear it on the Remembering Ornette section of our podcast. He says that it was in the churches of New Orleans where he went to play when he was stranded there for a while for financial situation. And he was staying with a very church-oriented family, and he used to go and play in the church. And he said, and he says it in his own words, he says, "That's where I learned to play free."
Mm-hmm.
So now how many people would say, "Oh, I hear the church in Ornette"? Well, nobody, but that's because they're ignorant.
Right. They wouldn't recognize it if they heard it. It's like
Right. Racism. Right.
You can easily not see racism. Millions of Americans refuse to see it. They haven't been taught to recognize it. They don't even have the vocabulary to discuss this. And I raise this issue because some writers, critics, have discussed and resented the fact that I write about racism, white racism, in the United States. And as soon as they learn that, I'm convinced they put the book down. Because things they say suggest they haven't completed the book. But I said the book is the life and times of Lester Young. Now, how can you write about the life and times of Lester Young without writing about the racism that he and his family and his father and other musicians and other black people encountered every day? Well, let me tell you, there are a lot of people out there for whom U.S. history has no racial component or bias to it.
Wow.
In fact, if you read their histories that they write, you see that black people don't even exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people like Samuel Eliot Morison, they write maybe a sentence or two mentioning slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a special talent to recognize the tremendous artistry of black people and black musicians, but being unable to see them as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that takes a special talent. It's profound, in fact, how people refuse to acknowledge the humanity of black people. I ask people, how could black people create the art forms they've created? Gospel, spirituals, jazz, blues, ragtime, hip-hop, cool, etc., without having major funding from the national government? You know, the organizations most important for funding jazz, other than the church, has been the underworld, mm-hmm. for lack of a better name. These guys who ran the nightclubs liked the music. Now, Earl Hines has written about the underworld and jazz in an Ebony article around 1950. But, you know, this is an interesting idea. The music came from a kind of underworld, jazz culture. And the people who supported it were from the underworld, white gangsters as well as black gangsters. But the symphonies, the universities, the foundations, the major philanthropic foundations, they ignored the music until, I don't know, 1960s or thereabouts.
Nope.
How could they do that easily? In fact, at my institution, the University of California, Santa Barbara, the music department, a professor told me this some 35 years ago, passed a resolution saying there would be no playing of jazz on their practice pianos.
Oh, my goodness. Unbelievable.
These white men, and that's what they mostly were, have nothing else to do but sit around passing resolutions such as this. But this is, you know, I mean, I'm sure if someone came to them, wrote them as an entering graduate student saying, "I want to learn how to play jazz," in, say, 1980, that's what we're talking about, not today, it's different today, they would send them packing. And a lot of music departments are like that, have been like that. But now they're getting smart. And you have institutions such as Wesleyan and the one in Ohio, Oberlin, which are opening up to new ideas and which are hiring musicians. Wayne State.
The new school.
Of course, huh?
The new school in New York has a good jazz studies.
And I've forgotten to mention the Pioneer School, North Texas State University.
That's right.
Which was doing this in the 1850s. So things have changed, but still I can tell by the rapid responses to my dealing with racism that there are a lot of people would be much happier if I wrote, "Oh, Lester Young was a cool dude, do-do-do-do-do-do." And you had, you know, once I asked a musician, I think it was Jesse Drakes, what did Lester like to play? You know, you start off with a simple question and you get a complicated answer. He said, Lester liked to play the blues. And he emphasized that. Now, if you listen to Lester, you hear a lot of blues. But this was reflective of a larger reality. Blues was an important idiom at that time, the most important. Some have called it, Scholar has called it, like, what was the word he used? An epistemology, he called it. Late professor in Black Studies at UCSB. His name escapes me because my memory is fading. And I'm ashamed to admit that, but I can't think of his name right now. And he's written about the Mississippi Delta and the politics of the Mississippi Delta and the Black culture that resulted from that specific milieu, the Mississippi Delta in the state of Mississippi. Blues is an epistemology. Lester liked the blues because it represented his life and the life of his people. Lester had to deal with racial discrimination in hard times. And that's why he played the blues.
Yeah, there's a great quote. You probably heard it. It's a recording. Somebody, I think a French guy's interviewing him. And somehow the blues comes up. And he says, well, something like this. If he said, I'm paraphrasing it. If you can't play the blues, you can't play shit.
Oh, that's Lester Young said that.
Lester Young said that.
Yeah.
It's on recording somewhere. I mean, he was absolutely, you know, no question that was essential for being a musician, an American musician. Yeah,
yep.
So I'm glad we brought these things up because yeah, it's literal insanity to try to understand and appreciate Lester Young unless you understand the conditions in which he grew up and, you know, lived, and to try to exit out the racism from that is a kind of madness. It's just crazy.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Racism has been identified as a mental illness, you know.
Yeah. No.
That's the way it is.
Say that shouldn't be part of his story or, you know, it's obviously the main story, or I don't know what the main story is, but one of the big things is what he accomplished. But you always have to look at what somebody accomplished in contrast with what they had to go through to accomplish it, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
He practiced as a youngster. He practiced a lot. You know, Lester tells the story of how he was just faking it, and his father tricked him and found out he was just faking it and cursed him and put him out of the band and everything. Just one second. I'm back. I'm sorry. I got interrupted, but I have the name of the professor that I was thinking about, Clyde Woods, who wrote about blues. Clyde Woods. It's his first book.
So we were talking about how Lester's father was suspicious, maybe, that Lester wasn't really reading music. And tricked him and exposed him and was kind of irate that he hadn't learned to read music. And
He was very, very angry. The same thing happened to a lot of musicians, I'm sure, who were faking it, like Eddie Bearfield, for example. But Lester was put out of the band until he learned to read. And in just about every oral history interview, he tells that story. And it's one of those things that he never got over. But, you know, he was a reading musician, and maybe he didn't know the musical theory as well as other people, but he had a natural ear. You know, when your father's a musician, what's his name? Founder of rock and roll, as he's called, Louis Jordan. His father was a musician. His father was a professor of music. Very similar experience. Just like, you know, the Jacksons, their father was a musician. Just like the Marsalis brothers. We haven't paid enough attention to the family's role in maintaining this music. We talk about the church, but what's the name of those guys in New Orleans? They started out as the Meters.
Oh, I can't think of the name, but when you mention New Orleans, I mean, there's the Andrews families, there's the Latsy family, there's Batiste's, there's Marcellus's. It's just, and these are families with, you know, 5, 10, sometimes 20. Oh, I know what you mean, the Neville family.
The Neville family, yeah. And then there were a bunch of singers that came out in the late 60s. 6 or 7 singers, brothers, all came out of Mississippi. The family has played a major role in, you know, for example, Nat Cole's brother, Freddie Cole, is a musician, plays piano, sings, sounds just like his brother.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And often musicians will say something like, well, my sister was the really talented one. That's what Oscar mm-hmm. Peterson said about his sister. She had mm-hmm. real talent, he'll say. Well, that might be a young Oscar Peterson comparing himself to an older sister. And
but it is amazing how many times you'll hear a very accomplished musician like Ornette, for example, say, yeah, but you never, you know, I would say, oh, you know, so-and-so was amazing. He goes, yeah, but you never heard, and he mentioned a name. The guy had never recorded.
That's right.
Sort of regional player, never had occasion. You know, it's something that we overlook. If you're from Kansas City or if you're from Louisiana, you know, now you just get on a plane and fly to New York.
If you got someone to cover the ticket, yes.
Well, that's a whole, yeah, that issue too. But this required a lot of resources and a lot of support to happen. It wasn't something that was easy in the old days. You know, it's a big deal to go from the South to the North or from one big city to another big city.
Well, let's just say it took a community to produce the musicians. Now, what Cab Calloway says in his autobiography of Minnie the Moocher and Me is a quote that I refer to again and again. He says, you talk about the Duke Ellingtons and the Count Basies, but they're not the real creators of the music. He says the real creators of this music are those little bands and little corner nightclubs playing Friday and Saturday nights, maintaining the tradition through terrible hardships. Those are the real creators and sustainers of this music. In other words, Duke Ellington and the Count Basies and others, they're just the froth on top of the brew.
Right. Right.
It's anonymous musicians, such as the ones you referred to, who never recorded. Those are the ones who play such a crucial role. As I tell people, look, it's basically what we would today call homeless people, hobos, low-life creep people, riding the rails people who created a major art form, blues. Think about that. Anonymous souls created this major art form.
Yep.
As we would call them today, homeless people, bums, mm-hmm. raggedy souls running around with guitars, chasing women, fighting, drinking. It's something to think about.
Yeah. And often the ones that we do know about, it was a series of happy accidents that allow that particular individual to get
yes.
a foothold. And
that's right. That's what Duke said. People say, how did you get where you are? He said, well, someone told me to ask that man on the corner where to go, and I went down, and he directed me to another corner. And I asked that man on the corner which way to go, and he directed me in another direction, and I ran into another man, and that's how I got where I am today.
Yeah, that's kind of how it works in every field, huh?
There was no preconceived plan, in other words.
Right, no jazz program to enroll in with kindly teachers. Hey, let's talk about Lester's time in Kansas City that was so formative. So we've covered to a degree the background that where he came from, and then he found himself in Kansas City with Count Basie and others.
Yes. Well, actually, he visited Kansas City several times before he lived there. And we should be aware that he lived there only about a year.
Really?
That is to say, he first appears in the city directory, as I recall, the Kansas City City Directory, in 1935, and he leaves in late 36. So that's about a year. He spent more of his time in Minneapolis. He came to Minneapolis with his father's band in 1926, and he stayed there until 1935. But he's a musician, and though he likes to stay in one place, which was at this time Minneapolis, where he had a wife in an apartment, and I guess a steady gig, he also was lured by road travel. And he traveled with a number of bands in the late 20s and early 30s with Art Boston, I believe, with the Bostonians, Art Bronson's Bostonians. He played with Eddie Bearfield and Leroy Snake White in the late 20s. And in the early 30s, from about 1932, he was with really formidable band, the Oklahoma City Blue Devils, which had Hot Lips Page in it, Buster Smith and Eddie Durham and a host of other people. Jimmy Rushing, for example, was with the Blue Devils. Count Basie said it was the best band he ever heard, and he played for a time with the Blue Devils. So though people talk about Kansas City, it's the Oklahoma City Blue Devils which probably played as large, if not a greater role in his life. They traveled throughout the Southwest and the Northern Plain states, and then the band got stranded in Oklahoma City around 1934, spring of 1934, summer of 34. And few surviving members of the Blue Devils made it back to Oklahoma City and Kansas City and places such as that. So it's then that Lester, who probably went back to Minneapolis at first because that's where his wife was in 34, it's then that Lester eventually finds his way to Kansas City, which was not only a place which had the local musicians who made names for themselves, but a number of Texans, for example, Eddie Durham, Oran, Hot Lips Page, Buster Smith, they made their home in Kansas City in the 1930s, as did the Red Bank, New Jersey man, William Count Basie. And Basie put together a band around 1935, and his motto was, we got to get some Blue Devils in here. So he got Jimmy Rushing, he hired Hot Lips Page, he hired Lester Young, and others who were Blue Devils. And then John Hammond came along and thought the band should be larger than 9 or 10, so they added people to it, and then they went on the road, and then they were successful. Well, people place far too much emphasis, I think, on Kansas City as a mecca of jazz. I mean, jazz was everywhere. I've written about Oklahoma City. Last of the Blue, the 1 o'clock jump is the title of the book. And it focuses on that city, which hardly gets any attention in the history of jazz, though Jimmy Rushing came from Oklahoma City. Walter Page lived there for a number of years. He was the leader of the bassist in the Count Basie band. The rhythmic foundation behind the Count Basie band, as well as the Blue Devils. He lived in Oklahoma City for a number of years. Even Los Angeles had one of the three big bands, one of the three important New Orleans bands. So the original Creole jazz band was formed in Los Angeles as early around 1910 or 1911. So you find that Los Angeles played a role in the origins of this music. And these people heading out to New Orleans and San Francisco, they're not crazy. It's because the music is almost immediately national and perhaps even international. For example, before King Oliver was discovered in Chicago and asked Louis Armstrong to join him, the year before he had been playing out in San Francisco and Oakland. And also he traveled down to Los Angeles and played. The first One of the first jazz recordings was done by a group of musicians in Los Angeles. Some of them were from New Orleans, like Ed Kid Ory, for example, was leader of the band. And West Coast cities, other Midwestern cities, such as St. Louis, have played a major role in the history of this music from the beginning. This is at odds with the thesis that it started in New Orleans, of course. But if you look at UB Blake, he says they were playing jazz in the Baltimore area in the late 19th century. Carolina Shout, James P. Johnson said they were playing jazz in the Carolinas in the early 20th century. And no less an authority than James Weldon Johnson said, he wrote Black Manhattan and the Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, which is a novel, but it's a classic work. James Weldon Johnson maintained in Black Manhattan that jazz originated in New York City around 1905. So all this evidence coming from the musicians themselves, UB Blake, James Weldon Johnson was a musician, by the way, as well as a lawyer, suggests to me that the music is national from the beginning, if not international. Now, of course, as the largest city in the South, New Orleans, and as a port city close to the Caribbean, of course New Orleans played a role, a major role in the history of this music. Of course it played a, but I think we give it a little too much emphasis.
And then, and thereby neglect some other places like Oklahoma, which I
or
bet
Pittsburgh.
Is not, or Pittsburgh. Well, yeah, but you know, it's funny if you just list all the guys from Pittsburgh, or all the guys from Detroit, or all the guys from St. Louis. Suddenly, you realize there must have been an amazing scene there, for musicians of this quality to emerge. I think you made a really good point, and we made, it's worth repeating, is that when you see a talented, successful person, a musician that has notoriety and is well known, you're just seeing the tip of the iceberg of a community.
This is what Calloway says, yes. The church and families play major roles. They teach the children how to play music. Horace Tapscott said in his family, there was a piano right near the door. And he said every time you walked in the house, you had to touch the piano before proceeding. What an interesting idea. The piano is like a holy relic. So lots of people had pianos and made sure their young charges learned music. But for everyone who learned music, there were two or three who didn't. I think we should keep that in mind, too. It's not everyone who's learning music, but some really just take to it. Herbie Hancock is an example of he was one of those child prodigies. And he didn't know anything about jazz, he says in his autobiography, until he went to Hyde Park High School. Now, I ask, how could anyone growing up on the south side of Chicago in the 30s be ignorant of jazz? I'm not saying he's a liar, but certainly this requires some explication.
Yeah, that would be it. That would be, you'd have to make a very strange path through town to miss all the music that's going on.
He must have been so wrapped up in playing classical music that it just shut out everything else. And practicing, you know, when he went downtown to audition or something, and I'm not getting the story right, but I can give you the idea. And he did so well that they said to him, well, that's real good, you're number one and everything, but for the real contest in 6 weeks, we're not going to play that piece. We're going to play another piece. And he surmised that he did so well that they changed the piece that he was to play so that they could cut him out. So he went home and practiced furiously for the next 6 weeks. Furiously. With the new composition, and went back and played it and won the prize.
Well, this raises a point too, and you touched on it earlier. And this is so obvious, it almost seems ridiculous to say it, but apparently it needs to be said. You don't see a great musician without somebody who had tremendous discipline and work skills and who just poured themselves into their art. I mean, yes. I think there's this myth that, oh, you know, they're just native geniuses.
Oh, yeah, that's the way of discounting culture and intelligence. Yeah. One musician said, we're like brain surgeons. We're like medical doctors. We have to keep up to date.
Yep.
We put as much time practicing and learning and so forth, probably more than medical doctors. But it takes that kind of zeal. This is what Dizzy said. Some people would die to play this music. He said, in fact, they do.
Right.
Their
right.
love of it is so great that they won't work a regular job.
Right.
They don't eat regularly. They don't take care of themselves or go to doctors. They ignore ailments. And, you know, people never ask, why do so many of these young black musicians die so soon? Like, although today they know or used to know Jimi Hendrix, but look at Jimmy Blanton, the Ellington bassist. He was in his early 20s when he died, tuberculosis.
Yeah.
Margaret Johnson, the Countess, she died of tuberculosis. Charlie Christian, he was about 23 when he died, tuberculosis. 5 years later, his brother, Eddie Christian, died, tuberculosis.
Yeah.
Dolphy, I think it was uremia poisoning. Something similar killed Art Tatum in the mid-1950s. Now, it would be dishonest not to point out that some of these people have bad habits which lead to their demise, but it's not bad habits which give you tuberculosis, for example. And that's what killed so many people.
Yeah.
Black people in particular are susceptible to lung diseases for reasons I don't understand, and I don't know if anyone else understands it either. But tuberculosis has killed a lot of musicians and killed them when they were young. Probably killed more people than illicit drugs. But
yeah,
these are the realities these people have to live with. For example, Walter Page died in the dead of winter walking with his bass in New York City. Why didn't the man take the taxi?
Right.
Did he not have the money to take the taxi? I mean, that's nice to do when you're young and healthy in your 20s and 30s. But this is like 1961. He was in his late 50s then.
Yeah, I think people are, as familiar people are with the tragedies of early death in jazz, I'm afraid if you really lay it all out, it's far worse than most people realize. And you're right, a tremendous percentage had to do with treatable medical conditions.
Yeah.
Treatable. That's the other part of this.
They had poor health care.
Yeah. And so the dedication factor that brought us to this, the dedication factor is just huge. This is the focus of their life, creating music and advancing their art. And this is why we have this music. It didn't fall from the sky. It's not the native talent just springing up out of nowhere. I mean, there's communities and churches and schools and individuals making the decision that this is what they're going to do with their life, and the communities that form around that. And I'm glad you pointed out that this was not just New Orleans to Kansas City to Chicago to New York. This was a nationwide phenomenon. And these cultures, these communities and cultures existed throughout the whole country, not just a few hotbeds.
And who's to say that we don't have similar counterparts coming out of Cuba,
mm-hmm.
Brazil,
mm-hmm.
Jamaica, Trinidad. And I think new studies are indicating that this music is really international. Jazz blues is part of an international. You know, in the Congo, the most popular music form is what they call Congolese jazz, or maybe hip-hop is taking over, but I didn't see that so much. Congolese jazz, rumbas, cha-cha-chas, etc. They took the music, they see, from the so-called Latin bands, Afro-Latin bands, actually, that they heard on records or that traveled on ships when they were seamen. And they, as they say, they took back their music. The Afro-Latin music came from the Congo and West Africa, and they just reclaimed it.
Yep.
OK Jazz, Verki, Rochero, the list of Congolese musicians is, it just goes on and on. I can't think right now of the most famous one, but he had a chalet in Paris. He was a leader of OK Jazz, Orchestra Congo, OK Jazz was the name of his band. His name will come to me in a minute. And, you know, my research, which I mentioned, my current research shows that jazz was being played in the Philippines as early as 1922. And in Tokyo, about the same time. In fact, I have surmised that traveling musicians on the Japanese ocean liners came to the United States. And we know their names, you know, because they introduced bands on ocean liners around 1912, 1913 in Japan, and they connected it with a music school that they started at the same time. So these musicians would come to San Francisco, and after eating a steak and getting some cigars, they would go down to the music store, Clay's Music Store or what have you, and they'd get the latest music. And when people told them, when they learned at the store that these guys were musicians from Japan, they gave them sheet music, some of the latest sheet music. And at this time, and though this isn't known, San Francisco was a mecca in some ways of jazz. Sid Prati's jazz band, the So Different Jazz Band, was performing in San Francisco as early as 1915, 1916, before the original Dixieland Jazz Band. And Paul Whiteman and others were playing in San Francisco at this time. So jazz music and jazz dances were familiar to these Japanese musicians. And they took them back to Japan. Shanghai in the 1930s in particular was another stronghold, you might say. Wilbur Buck Clayton, the gentleman I mentioned earlier, went to Shanghai with a group of musicians, Gentlemen of Harlem, in 1934. And he played at the Canadrome, I believe, a big resort for foreigners and tourists, etc. Spent 1.5 years or so playing in Shanghai, China. And he and a Chinese musician tried to adapt Chinese music to jazz. Again, he writes about this in his autobiography, something he did with Nancy Miller Elliott. So the music is international within a few short years. There's an English historian, Eric Hobsbawm, who points out in one of his books that other than Islam, the religion, nothing has spread across the world as quickly as jazz. Nothing. Of course, he was writing in the 1950s, before the iPhone, before the fax machine, before Xerox, etc., before TV even was popular. But that's something to think about, I believe. The music spread with lightning rapidity. In the early 20s, Langston Hughes was listening to a jazz band in the place where he washed dishes in Paris. The history of black people overseas is something that hasn't really been given the attention it deserves, but there were musicians traveling to Europe, singers in particular, the Fisk Jubilee singers and others, late in the 19th century and early 20th century. And the Fisk Jubilee singers also went through Australia and New Zealand, Japan, India in the 1890s. So these people had some familiarity with black musical art forms. And then in the 1920s, Teddy Weatherford musician with roots in New Orleans and Chicago, established himself in Bombay, I believe, as well as Shanghai. He's the one, in fact, that brought Buck Clayton and his band to Shanghai in 1934. Every year or so, Weatherford would go and would get some musicians from the United States, and they'd come to Bombay or Shanghai or Tokyo or the Philippines. So the history of the music is international from the very beginning, first 5 or 10 years, certainly by the first 5 years. By 1922, it's cropping up in Asia.
And for, you know, for people that might lack historical perspective or technological historical perspective, nobody was flying to Japan in those days. You were taking a slow boat. It was a big undertaking.
That's right.
To get, yeah.
And there weren't that many records either between, you know, the first so-called jazz record was 1917, though there's evidence that Wilbur Sweatman, some would argue, a biographer Wilbur Sweatman argues that he made the first jazz recording in December 1916. You know, the real question is, well, what is jazz? How do you decide that this is jazz and that isn't jazz? Well, I let greater intellects deal with that. I just deal with the music, and if you call it jazz, I'll deal with that. But the recordings that really catapulted people into the limelight were made in 1923, right outside of Chicago, when they recorded King Oliver, and they recorded Jelly Roll Morton, and they started recording Bessie Smith about that year, too, I believe, either 1923 or 1924. So that's the era of the records. And you don't have to be a musician to come back and spread the music in Japan or India or China. You can just be a person who works on the boat, buys a few records, and comes back. You could be a diplomat's son in Chicago, for example.
Well, I did a little research. I was very curious as to how a city like Liverpool could have produced a band like the Beatles. And that's where I discovered, well, there's no such thing as just a few geniuses. It's a whole community. And it turned out that Liverpool being on New Orleans, you know, New Orleans was still an export port for cotton, and Manchester was still a big milling city, and the port for Manchester was Liverpool, and
sure,
that's why that somewhat obscure northern English city had this flowering of rhythm and blues people, out of which emerged this one particular winner band, and it was soldiers and sailors who would bring their own records, or some.
Yeah.
So there was a guy that was famous for bringing records, a merchant marine, and he would bring cases of records, sell them, and he made enough money to buy a car back home. So that's one pathway.
Port cities.
Yeah.
Port cities, Yokohama, Bombay,
yeah.
Shanghai,
yeah.
Manila,
yeah.
All port cities.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we can find others. Paris is different, of course, but Paris is the capital. And, you know, I spent a week or so in Ethiopia a few years ago, and I came across a photographic book of Ethiopian jazz bands.
Really?
In the 1930s and 1940s in Addis Ababa. And just like Louis Armstrong and the others in the movies, these guys, mostly guys, wear tuxedos. And they assumed the positions, you know, clowning positions with the instrument up in the air. The women wear evening gowns, the women who are singers. And even in East Africa, movies such as the Gene Krupa story had influenced one of the musicians that I interviewed, a drummer who played with a Swahili popular music band. These are known as Tata bands.
Mm-hmm.
But he played a jazz drum set, and he got the idea, he said, from the movie The Gene Krupa Story, which was very, very popular in the 1950s when he probably was a teenager. Now, others played other kinds of drums, bongos, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But this is one of these musicians who had a jazz drum set in the midst of this Tata band.
Wow.
So there are great things happening in with the music as we speak. I did some research on Tata music in East Africa in 1994, and I came back with a CD. I'm sorry, it was a tape called Swahili Rap, and there's a guy in it with sunglasses and hooded sweatshirt on the cover, okay? So I said, now this is a Swahili rap. Now this is 21 years ago. I played it for my class and they just laughed. I stopped. I said, what are you laughing at? They said, he just sampled the L.A. rap musician so-and-so, so-and-so. He's an underground musician and he sampled him. I said, oh my goodness. My students know more about Swahili rap than I do.
Wow. And your students were in Santa Barbara?
Yes. Many of them from Los Angeles. So they immediately, and of course they're clued into what they call underground hip-hop. And they recognize it. So this Swahili artist has sampled a musician from Los Angeles that I didn't even know and put it in his music. And of course, only the word, Cognoscenti would recognize that. But the international dimension of the music is diminished in the traditional histories. There's a book that just came out a few years ago called Bombay Foxtrot. And it's about the introduction of jazz to Indian society through the port city of Bombay. Teddy Weatherford, for example, was one of the people who played a role. And before him, there was another one. Abby Lane was the first African-American musician to come through and play jazz. And then there was another one, a band leader named Cricket Smith. But these were some of the people introducing jazz to Bombay in the late 20s and early 30s. And the musicians from the enclave of Goa, G-O-A, which was a Portuguese colony, easily took to this music because these people were familiar, the Goans, as they called them, were familiar with Western traditions, having studied Portuguese and Western music from the 1500s. And more readily than the musicians of India who came from an oral tradition, these Goan musicians played a prominent role in the adoption and spread of jazz in India and in the Orient. Filipino musicians played a similar role. They are often in the jazz bands of African Americans, subbing or playing or enlarging the band, whether the band is in Shanghai or Tokyo or what have you. Richie Quirino, Q-U-I-R-I-N-O, has interviewed a number of Filipino musicians and has written about Filipino jazz. He's got three books on the subject. He's a musician himself, and he, interestingly, Richard Quirino, had studied at the Berklee School of Music in Boston. You know, 20% of the musicians I've learned at the Berklee School of Music are from Japan, and I thought, they must have a quota.
Well, you know, I sent you a clip about this. I'm not sure if you had a chance to look into it.
I don't know. Which one?
Well, I met these guys who are documenting this scene in Japan, and it is unbelievable. Before the war, and then very much after the war, a lot of jazz, what they call jazz cafes, is a special word in Japanese. I can't remember what it is, but we'll call them cafes, but they're not the kind of cafes we think about. They're small rooms. They may only sit six, seven, eight guys. And there's a little bar, but, you know, makeshift kind of thing, nothing fancy. And they were designed and still operate. There's over 100 of them still in existence, specifically as listening centers where you'd go after work or at lunch or whatever to hear the latest American jazz records.
Yes, they started that in the 20s. They were milk bars at that time because milk was gaining popularity. Then they became coffee houses, but they played jazz records. And you could go there and sit for hours. And there was a similar place in Yokohama. I've forgotten its name, but it's a very famous jazz club or coffee house where all the greats have played in the 50s and 60s and 70s. I'm supposed to know the name of it, but if you just mention it to any musician who's played there, they'll immediately name it because it's just that famous. I've spent time in Yokohama doing research, and what I noticed is that all the restaurants that I went to in Yokohama played jazz.
Wow.
Played the jazz of the 1950s. And sometimes you'd hear Miles Davis, and sometimes you'd hear Sarah Vaughan, for example, or you'd hear Charlie Parker. Now, in Tokyo, it wasn't like that. But Yokohama, a port city, has a close association with the history of jazz. In fact, every year for about 15 years now, they've had a jazz promenade, they call it, in Yokohama, the first or second weekend. I'm going there in October. And this is what they have on Saturday and Sunday. In several major concert halls, they have musicians playing every 50 minutes. So right away you have like six concert halls, over 12 hours, you have 12 different bands. That's 72 bands right there. And then the lesser known musicians play on the street corners outside the concert halls, all up and down the street. You know, I'm walking down the street getting ready to go in a concert hall, and I see some youngsters, young men playing jazz. I hear a Charlie Parker riff, you know. I think, my goodness. And Yokohama thinks of themselves as New Orleans when it comes to jazz. And they have this jazz promenade every year. Most of the musicians are from Japan, but some of the bands have African Americans or West Indians in them. That's where I first heard the Tokyo Cuban Boys, an Afro-Cuban band, which goes back to the late 1940s. I interviewed some members who are in the band today, and the guy said, leader of the band said, look, this is what happened. My father started the band in 1948, and then about 15 years later, the band folded. But the demands for the band were so much, and after we got a call from Cuba to come visit them, I gave up my rock and roll gig, found the old-time musicians, got some new ones, and relaunched the Tokyo Cuban Boys. And we went to Cuba, where we were feted for several weeks. If you go to a search engine like, I don't know, Amazon.com, for example, or even Safari, I don't know, and you type in Tokyo Cuban Boys, you'll see the Afro-Latin renderings of this Japanese Afro-Cuban band. And I said, where'd you get the instruments from? He said, we made them. Yep. I said, how'd you know how to make them? And he pointed to his ear, you know. That is to say, they had movies. They had their own traditions of making drums. And of course, Latin, so-called Latin music, which is really African-American music from the Caribbean, invaded Japan and China in the 1920s. You know, Argentina, tango dancers, Latin bands from Cuba and so forth, and musicians, they went on tours that included Tokyo, Shanghai, Bombay, Manila, and such places. Even in Japan in the 1930s, in the dance halls, the taxi dance halls, they would have popular bands, you might call them jazz dance bands, play for 30 minutes, and then the next 30 minutes, an Afro-Latin band would take over. And that's the way they alternated it through the night. So these musicians popularized Afro-Cuban music starting around 1948 during the occupation, and the music faded, and then they brought it back again with the son of the original founder. I mean, what a story. And they were feted in Cuba. Their reputation had reached Cuba. Of course, here in the United States, we don't know anything about the Tokyo Cuban Boys, and I tell people about them, they think I'm kidding. I must be joking.
It's amazing. And you, this is your next big project, is that right?
Yes, yes. Pacific Coast Jazz, yes. I've been working on it several years. I'm very slow.
Well, I'm glad we got a sneak peek of it because it sounds fascinating. And
it is.
And it shows something about the strength of the music, that it leaves the ocean decades before I think the average jazz fan realizes.
Now, in China, jazz is just beginning to catch on. Mm-hmm. I ran into some musicians from Oberlin, another guy from Wesleyan, you know, he had a nightclub. But in Japan, that's China, but in Japan, the music is deeply rooted. That is to say, there are people who consider themselves jazz musicians. And, you know, at the jazz promenade, I heard a particular composition, and later I said, what was that? Oh, they said that was Thelonious Monk's Green Chimneys. And I thought, I had to come to Japan to hear Green Chimneys?
Yeah.
So I came back home, I fumbled around, I finally found it, and I played it. I said, that's it. They are thoroughly into the music. Plus, they have their own composers, of course.
Yep.
You know, one guy had a whole set, 50 minutes long, that he devoted to Duke Ellington. And when I ran into the head of the Duke Ellington Society of Japan, I asked him a question. I said, you know, some people don't consider Ellington's later music to be jazz. You know what he said?
What?
We don't question Duke Ellington in Japan.
That's great. That's the right answer.
That's profound. We let these lesser people go around, well, this is jazz, and this isn't jazz, and this is half jazz. But we don't play games like that. It's Ellington. That's enough.
And if he says it, it's good enough for us. Oh, my goodness. Oh,
Ellington said something interesting. He said, in Europe, they take jazz too seriously. And in the United States, they don't take it seriously enough.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing about Japan and the United States. I mean, I've talked to a number of musicians. They really take it seriously.
Well, these little coffee houses, and coffee house is not really the right name, but they, and I've seen pictures of them, that's how I got hip to this, is two guys, one from New York and one from Belfast, they've been living in Japan for years now, and slowly they stumbled on these clubs, or these cafes, and they decided to start photographing them and writing them up, and these places look like shrines. The seats are all oriented towards the speakers. There's no talking. You can buy a drink, of course, but there's no talking. And there's usually two beautifully handcrafted speakers, you know, as audiophiles like to hand-make their own equipment. And you go there to listen and enjoy the music in the presence of other people who have the same reverence.
Is it live or recorded?
This is recorded.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I'll send you the link. It's something to look into. He had been there years, he said, before he realized how vast this network of little jazz cafes. They're typically falling out now. They're starting to disappear.
Right.
They boomed after the war, as you pointed out, with post-war occupation.
Oh, after World War One.
After World War Two.
No, after World War One, they started.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, chop houses, sometimes they call it. No, it's after World War One in the 20s. And because of the Kanto earthquake in 1923, a number of people had to leave Tokyo and go to Yokohama. So besides being Yokohama, besides it being a port city, it got reinforcements, you might say. So there were these coffee houses in places like Yokohama from about 1924, 1925, if not sooner. But I'm sure you're correct. After the occupation, after World War II, they just mushroomed because jazz did too.
Yep.
You know, Hampton Hawes writes about jazz in Japan. Have you read his autobiography?
No.
Raise Up Off Me. He spends a chapter or two writing about his experiences in Yokohama. In fact, that's where he met the famous Toshiko, as we call her, the pianist, Akiyoshi, in Japan, and he was shocked because she knew about Bud Powell and everything. This would have been about 1952, 53, before she was quote-unquote discovered.
Wow. We got kind of two for one here. We got a lot of exposition about the background that Lester Young emerged from, and we also got a preview of your next work, which I can't wait. I'll be the first in line to get a copy.
Can't wait either.
I bet you really can't wait. But, you know, how jazz really spread much earlier and much faster and much broader in Asia than it, most of us have any idea. Pardon?
We don't have any inkling of that.
Wow. I wonder if we could start wrapping this up by talking about, let's just arbitrarily call it the third phase of Lester Young's career. We talked about his early training. We talked about sort of a little bit about his breakthrough, which involved his association with Count Basie and, you know, which put him in the national spotlight. I wonder, do you think we can talk a bit about the third part of his career?
Well, he came out to Los Angeles. He played in the Lee and Lester Young band for a while. They went to New York, then his father died, and the band broke up. And he rejoined Basie, but then he got drafted. And the tale about how an FBI agent in a zoot suit accosted him and was talking to him and Joe Jones and Jive Talk and everything, and then showed his badge and said, "Report for duty at the draft board Monday morning," is a beautiful story. So he went into that's the best part of it. He went into the military, and it was a disaster. Nobody like Lester Young should have been drafted to serve in the U.S. military. So he spent a lot of time in detention, and people say, well, that changed Lester Young, made him bitter and so forth and so on, whereas musicians I've interviewed disagreed with that. He played with jazz at the Philharmonic after he came out of the military in the late 40s and early 50s, and he went to Japan with jazz at the Philharmonic.
Uh-huh.
And I think they went to the Philippines and Hawaii, as well as throughout the United States, and European tours. He was going to Europe. That's where he spent his last few weeks, in fact, in Paris in 1959. So he was discovered by the Europeans in jazz at the Philharmonic, as well as on Basie recordings. And he played with various combos. Usually they were his combo, from about 1949, 1950, and he lived in New York City from about 1949, maybe a few years earlier, and he died in New York City in 1959. Now, what people like to emphasize is the fact that he left his family and his nice home on Long Island to live in an apartment, a hotel, the Alvin Hotel, near 52nd Street, I guess, where he could look out and see his friends, as he said. But, you know, he had major health problems, and he knew he didn't have long. He must have known he didn't have long to live. He was in the hospital a couple of times in the mid and late 50s, and we're not sure exactly what his ailments were, but since he was an alcoholic from sometime in the late 30s, especially in the 40s and 50s, we know that would have contributed to his poor health. And he didn't particularly like to eat. He would order meals and eat a few bites. And, you know, this is indication of a full-blooded, you might say, a far-gone alcoholic. That is to say, their appetite diminishes. But he continued to play. And though others say that his playing declined in the 50s, if you just listen to his, I think it's Prayers in Europe, around 1956, maybe December 56, it came out about 10 years ago, I think it's Prayers in Europe, the man is playing with such fire that you wonder how anyone could claim that after the military, Prayers' powers declined. No musicians agree with that critical assessment. Just like anyone else, he had good days and he had bad days. And I learned an important lesson from a musician with whom I discussed this issue. I think it was Connie Kay who said this. I said, well, they said Prayers wasn't playing as well his last years. What do you think? Because Connie Kay played with him in the 50s. He said, Well, with an imitator, you can tell they're not playing as well because they didn't play it like they did yesterday. But with an originator, how do you know he's not playing well? People like Prez and Bird, they're trying something different every time they get on the bandstand.
Right.
So it's impossible to say, well, they played well this night or they didn't play as well last night, because each time they get up there, they're creating something new. Originators are different from imitators. But as Jimmy Heath said, this is a society of here comes another one just like the other one. We love imitators. We love people who we can say, oh, yeah, he sounds just like so-and-so, so-and-so. But when we get originators like Coleman Hawkins or someone, I'm sorry, or that Coleman or someone like that, people say, well, I don't know.
I have to say that the small group recordings of Lester Young are some of my favorite music ever I've ever heard from any source, any country, any time. So, yeah, I always wondered about that. Oh, he didn't play as well. I'm like,
have you heard him with Nat Cole?
Yes, that's what I'm thinking about. Oh, my goodness.
It's just,
and to hear Nat Cole play piano so well, a lot of people aren't aware that he was a master.
Oh, yeah. The jazz musicians I interviewed him know him primarily as a pianist rather than so much as a singer.
Yeah.
But
if you haven't discovered that, folks, definitely find. We've got videos on Jazz on the Tube of him playing, and you'll see he was second to no one on the piano.
That's right. That's what the musicians say, and I take what they say very seriously. Whereas there are other people out there, writers like me, who think their opinion is to be valued more than that of the musicians who knew and played with Lester Young. And I find that rather strange, if not arrogant. But, you know, I know we're supposed to be wrapping this up, so
yeah.
It's been a pleasure talking with you. Anytime you want to call me and talk about something, I love this so much. If I have a deadline and can't talk, I'll be sure to let you know. But,
okay.
You know, I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation with you. And I say, you're on the right track, Ken. McCarthy, is that Irish?
It's Irish, it is.
Yeah. Keep on keeping up.
Well, thank you, Professor Daniels. And we've been talking with Professor Douglas Henry Daniels, author of a lot of stuff, but we focused today on Lester Leaps In, a book that I really love, and I think now you know a little bit why from hearing Professor Daniels talk about the depth of the history of this such an important artist for not just jazz, not just music, but an American artist who really opened so many pathways for thousands.
Yeah, B.B. King said Lester was his influence.
So many, huh? So many people have said that. Musicians say it. And I love what you say about the critics. I have a young nephew who's a musician, and he's helping me out. He's a very fine writer. He's writing some of the emails for me for Jazz in the Tube and in a recent email.
That's how you do it.
Oh, it's the only way I can
labor.
Do it. I'm cheating, right? I tell you, he gets paid pretty well. It's better than working at McDonald's. And so he quoted a critic, and
good.
I wrote him. I said, Sam, we don't care what critics have to say. Just throw that out. And he got it right away. I said, I only care about the music and what musicians have to say about it. I'm not interested in what musical critics
have
to say about it.
Some of them have some good things to say.
Some
of them have some good things to say. Dan Morgenstern, for example, Wilmer. But so many of the others are just so opinionated. Just one second.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, someone keeps calling me, so I might as well.
Well, thank you so much. And
thank you. It's an honor.
All right. Professor Douglas Henry Daniels, author of many books, including Lester Leaps In. Broaden your knowledge, broaden your appreciation, and get with these books. Thank you so much. We'll talk again.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.